Well, hello, everybody. This is Scott Linebrink back with another edition of Get in the Game podcast, where we talk about what it means to live faith in action. I'm very excited today to have a special guest. This is not an athlete, but this is a guy that is very well versed in so many topics talking about faith. And so I want to welcome Randy Alcorn. Randy, thank you for being here.
Hey, Scott. Great to be with you, brother.
Good to be with you, too. I'm going to introduce Randy to our audience here. Randy is the author of 60 books. He is the founder of Eternal Perspectives Ministries, which is an organization dedicated to serving the unreached, unfed, unsupported, unborn, unreconciled, and untrained people of the world. And I love the way that is stated, because that is such a wide range of people. And I know your books and you speaking at events like Pro Athletes Outreach, which is where I first got to meet you, has just had a real impact on people and in my life included. And I would point out specifically the Treasure Principle and your book on heaven. Just really enjoy the way that you unwrap topics and put different perspectives and bring in gospel truths. And so, Randy, I'm very appreciative, and it's a real privilege to know you personally and to have you here today.
Thanks, Scott. Likewise, it's great to be with you.
All right. So we've got some things that we're going to talk about here, and we've discussed them in advance. And so I'm excited to dive into this topic, this few topics here. But I would love for you to share with our audience, because this is your story really impacted me, because you had a decision to go up against the abortion clinics in your area, and that had a profound impact on your life and your lifestyle. And I was wondering if you could share that story for our audience.
Well, back in the early 80s, I got involved in what's now called pregnancy resource centers, then were called crisis pregnancy centers. And as a pastor, I volunteered to recruit other pastors to try to get them concerned for women who were pregnant and didn't have means to raise a child and were abortion prone. You know, they were vulnerable to, tempted to get abortions, and really felt like we needed to be doing more to help mothers in need, instead of just saying, don't get an abortion. We'll help you in this process if you want to place your child for adoption, whatever. So I was very involved in that. We opened our home to a pregnant girl who had actually had an abortion before, and this time she didn't get an abortion, and we helped place her child for adoption into a Christian home. And Nancy and I, what would it have been, 5-6 years ago, were actually present for the reunion of the birth mom with the child she had placed in for adoption into this Christian family. And wow. So we had the honor of being there and seeing them meet for the first time. And it was a very, very beautiful thing. And that girl came to be almost a member of our own family, became one of my wife's closest friends, and came to Christ when she was with us, which, by the way, let me just interject. A lot of people say, well, wait a minute, you know, these social ethical issues like abortion, and some people call it just a political issue. Of course, it is a political issue, but it's way more than that. And then people say, well, what does that have to do with the gospel? And what does that have to do with loving your neighbor? And how, what does that have to do with evangelism and people coming to Christ? Well, that's how she came to Christ, because we opened up our home and gave her an alternative to abortion and helped her. And now she's gone into prisons and done pro-life Bible studies with women who have had abortions and helped them deal with it, and then help other women to, should they be faced with that decision, to make the right one. So I got involved in that. Then after I was doing that for a while, peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience began to happen at abortion clinics. and modeled after the civil rights movement with Dr. King. And I really felt moved of God, and Nancy and I talked and prayed about it, really felt that I needed to do that. I needed to do more than just help in the ways that I had been helping and preach against it, and even opening our home and supporting the pregnancy centers. Felt like I needed to do something directly where the children were being killed at abortion clinics. So we went down to the largest abortion clinic in the state of Oregon, named Lovejoy, of all things, because it was on Lovejoy Street. And we didn't just protest. I tell people, well, you know, I wouldn't, if I see a child about to be run over by the car, I do something to get him out of the path of the car. And then somebody else could describe it as, oh, you were protesting drunk driving. No, I really wasn't. I was just trying to save the life of the child. That's what we were trying to do. And by God's grace, we did save numbers of lives, but the lawsuits against us in the state of Oregon were just pretty overwhelming. Had a 30-day trial in court. A judgment was brought against a group of us for $8.2 million, which I would always tell people that's more than I made as a pastor in a year, you know, so like way more. But, you know, as a result of that, I had to resign from pastoral ministry, and because they were coming to garnish my wages for the next 20 years, I could only make minimum wage. So it changed our lifestyle. Fortunately, we already had learned to give, but we gave all the royalties to my books to this day, go to Christian ministry. None of it goes to I keep saying us and we, as you know, my wife, Nancy, died 4 months ago. She's with Jesus, and I'm happy for her, sad for me. But I think I'll always say we about these things.
Sure. Yeah. That's an incredible sacrifice right there. I mean, I can imagine, you know, just going from having these resources available to you, and then all of a sudden you say, we are going to make a choice, a conscious choice. And you could have made more from the way I understand it, you could have made more, but that money that you made beyond minimum wage would have had to go to the abortion clinic, which you would have then been directly funding something you were protesting against. So it was a contradiction for you morally.
25% of my salary over minimum wage would go to an abortion clinic. And we could not live with that. The idea that the child killing industry would profit from the wages that I made, was better not to make wages. So
how, let me ask how your perspective was impacted as a result of that experience.
Well, it was definitely life-changing. Fortunately, I had written one of my early books that I wrote that actually came out in 1989. It was called Money, Possessions, and Eternity. And there's an updated version of that that's out there still today. But I had thought through God's ownership. He owns it all. And it's so interesting. He owns it all. I don't own it. I'm just a steward. I'm just a caretaker of God's money. I'm God's money manager, but it all belongs to him. So I wrote about that in the book. And little did I know that 1 year after that book came out, that I would no longer be able to have my name on any bank account. I couldn't, no checking account. I literally legally own nothing. And as my wife would remind me, you better be nice to me. I was, but it's like it all belonged to her and none of it belonged to me. And that, what a lesson. And to live that way, it was liberating, Scott, to have all the money from the books. And by the way, go to missions all over the world. Great. Causes, you know, I had Water Mission been around there in those days, definitely some of it would have gone there and some of it has gone there in recent years. But I mean, what a great opportunity for 100% of those royalties to go to Christian ministry. And then 20 years later, when the judgment was lifted, it was like, okay, so, and now it was, you can keep those royalties. And I mean, we're talking millions of dollars. I mean, the books have sold about 12 million copies. And so there's millions of dollars that have come in. And we went, why would we take those royalties? I mean, nothing could bring us more joy than for them to go where they've been going all over the world all this time.
Mm. Randy, listening to you give that testimony, I love how you describe the joy of that. And it reminds me of a gentleman that I talked to recently who is a Water Mission partner, very generous, has been blessed tremendously from a financial standpoint. And I asked him about his giving one time and why he does it or what part of it gives him joy. And he said, you know, Scott, he said, I have been blessed with making a lot of money. And he said, I don't trust myself with this money. I want to get it out of my hands as quickly as possible. And God keeps putting it in my hands, right. But I want to pass it. And that goes exactly to what you're saying about we don't own it. We just steward it.
Absolutely. And the thing that so many people miss is this is not only about the good of other people, though that would be sufficient reason for sure to love our neighbor as ourselves. It is not only about the glory of God, though that certainly would be sufficient reason. Nothing's more important than that God be glorified. But it is also for our good. Jesus said there's only one verse in the entire book of Acts that is not in the Gospels. A saying of Jesus that's not in the Gospels. And it's Acts chapter 20, verse 35, where it says, in most of our translations, it is more blessed to give than to receive. But that word, as I talk about in my book called Happiness and some of my related books to that, that Greek word makarios was the common word that was understood to mean happy making. It literally should be translated, it is more happy making to give than to receive. So in addition to everything else, it's not only for the glory of God and for the good of needy people, as great as those reasons are, it is also for our own personal good. It will make us happy. I have a 16-year-old grandson who this week is working with at an Indian tribe, doing building projects and cleanup and hanging out with kids. And he's texting me and telling me how this is the best trip he's ever been on. It's just so wonderful. It's just, he is so happy doing this. And some people go, man, that is a huge sacrifice. It's 111 the first day he's out there working and they have to wear jeans in 111 and, you know, all of that. And it's just truly happy making. And he could have been home and he could have been on doing video games and a bunch of other things, but he's happier serving and giving.
That's great. I love that. So you mentioned the books that you've written. You've written a lot of them. You've spoken on a lot of topics too. Topics like the persecution of Christians, God's design for heaven, the problem of suffering and evil, and how we are to view wealth and steward it well. How do you choose these topics? Or maybe I should ask, how do these topics choose you?
Yeah, I have felt in each case a definite leading of the Lord. And I learned long ago that if God is not 100% behind me writing this book, it's not going to be fun to write because it's a ton of work. It is a ton of work. And you know this from being a pro athlete in your years playing baseball, that what people see out there that might look kind of effortless by the time they're actually watching it is not effortless at all. You've invested huge amounts of training and sacrifice and preparation. And somebody will read one of my books and they'll say, oh man, that's a great book. It was really terrific. Was it easy to write or was it like hard to write? And go, the answer is always, it was extremely hard to write. Now, some are even extremely more than the others that were extremely hard to write. You know, it's not an easy thing to do. And it's like when writing is easy to read, it's hard to write. When it's easy to write, it's hard to read, you know? So That's how it is. But yeah, those books just, the Lord just lays them on my heart. So like when my mom died and I was reading to her every day in her last month before she died from Revelation 21 and 23 about, Revelation 21 and 22. Every day I'm reading to her about the new heavens and the new earth. And it hit me. Okay, so I went to Bible college and seminary, but we never talked about the new earth. We just talked about the present heaven, where it's better to go and be with Christ. It's better by far to be absent from bodies, present with the Lord. Today you'll be with me in paradise. That's all great. But then I was seeing, oh my word, this new earth, it's what heaven is ultimately going to become. And then all of a sudden I realized, okay, God, if you want me to, I really want to write a book on heaven that doesn't just talk about the present heaven, but talks about the post-resurrection heaven, the heaven we will live in with new bodies on a new earth forever. And that was an extremely difficult book to write. But literally, Scott, every day, pretty much without exception, we receive letters, emails, texts from people saying that their lives have been changed by the Heaven Book. And that's just one of those 60 books. And so I'm just deeply grateful to the Lord for his leading.
Yeah, I can tell you that you really opened my mind to see that the same things that God created here on earth for us that we enjoy, you know, why do I enjoy looking at a sunset or seeing a waterfall or standing on top of a mountain? All of these things he has designed within me because I'm made in his image and he's giving me things here to enjoy. And as we know, he built this place to be a paradise and sin interrupted that. But these very elements that we enjoy, why would we think that when we go to heaven, it's going to be a completely different experience, and we're going to see things that are completely foreign to us? We're going to get to enjoy the very things of beauty that we enjoy here, just at a greater capacity when we're there.
Exactly. And the key to everything is the resurrection body. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, if the dead are not raised, we are of all men most to be pitied. The idea of a disembodied state forever, like becoming like angels, was repugnant to Paul because human beings are not disembodied. God actually took that body that he made for Adam, then breathed into him the breath of life, the spirit. And that's when he became a person, a human being fully created in the image of God with both body and spirit joined together. So the saints in heaven, as Spurgeon said, are now awaiting the resurrection. It's better by far. It's wonderful. I know my wife Nancy's in the presence of Jesus, happier than she has ever been, and I'm delighted for her as much as I miss her. But the best is yet to come, the resurrection, life on the new earth. God is not content to let this earth just die and never be raised again. Just as our bodies die and are raised, this earth will die. It will come to an end in final destruction that actually is not final in that it will be raised, just like our bodies. Our bodies fully die. The earth will fully die. Our bodies will be fully brought back to life. The earth will be fully brought back to life. And God, we will celebrate forever that God's original dream, his purpose in creation, that righteous men and women would rule the earth for his glory, will be fulfilled forever on the new earth. Satan didn't win that battle against God. God won.
Mm. Love it. All right. So I'm going to ask you about a couple other topics and that you have touched on in several of your books. I know you could talk for days on these, but if you could just give us a nugget or a thought on money.
Yeah, I would say I'd go back to what I said before. Whenever I think of money, I think of giving and the privilege of giving, the grace of giving, and the fact that it is more happy making to give than to receive. And if people get that, it will revolutionize their lives so that they're not just giving out of duty, though that's reason enough to give, but they're giving out of joy and the overflow of grace in their lives.
All right. How about evil and suffering?
Yeah. The world is full of evil. It's full of suffering. I had a friend whose wife is suffering from dementia, who came over yesterday, and we were talking about this, and he was asking why, you know, why would God do this? I mean, he loves the Lord. He says, I don't understand what his purpose would be for my wife to suffer like this and for me to suffer like this. And I said, well, I don't understand the details, but I do know this, that God says that these light and momentary afflictions are achieving in us an eternal weight of glory that far outweighs them all. So suffering is not purposeless. God has a reason for it. And part of it, it says in scripture, is he is making us more Christ-like through our suffering. And one day he'll wipe away the tears from every eye. It'll all be taken away. And then in retrospect, we will see the truth that Romans 8:28 said all along, that all things work together for good to those who love God.
Yeah, that's a conversation I have often with my kids and with youth, because I think there's a permeating thought nowadays that if it's too hard, you know, I just need to find the path of least resistance or something easier. And right. And I love sharing my story too about, you know, the striving and the trials that came early on, especially in my baseball career. And how it was those hard knocks, those punches that we took that really helped develop character and make us who we were and make us adjust. And otherwise we would have just been comfortable to sit right where we are. But God purposely allows those trials to bring us to a more holier state.
Right. You know, if you write down on one side of a piece of paper all the best things that have ever happened to you, and then on the other side, write down all the worst things that have ever happened to you. And for some people, it might take several pages, you know. But then ask yourself the question, how many of the worst things that have happened in my life either directly or indirectly resulted in the best things that have ever happened in my life? And you'll be stunned to see Romans 8:28 already in your life. And the older you get, and I just turned 68, so the older you get, the more you see it. The younger you are, the less you see it. The older you are, the more you see it, if you're looking with the eyes of faith and looking through the lens of scripture.
So very true. So, Randy, let's go back to what we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, because there's a huge debate going on right now in our country about abortion. It's become a very political issue, and you mentioned that there's a broader sense of the problem than just political. As a leader in the faith community, how can we shine the light of the gospel into these conversations that many of us are having right now?
Well, I think we need to begin certainly prayerfully and with the understanding that this is a spiritual battle. Jesus said in John 8 that Satan is a liar. And when he lies, as the NIV translates it, he speaks his native language. He is very good at lying. And we as believers can be even fooled and deceived by him. And Jesus says, you know, I've come to bring you the truth, and the truth will set you free. When you know the truth, it will set you free. And what we need to start with abortion is, what is the truth? Because if this is just an issue of what a woman wants to do with her own body, she has the right to do what she wants to with her own body. The only thing she doesn't have a right to do is to harm someone else. Like a man has a right to do what he wants to do with his body, but there is a line that is drawn, because if he decides he wants to rape someone, which is something he's doing with his body, of course, then we know that's a horrible thing to do, because he doesn't have the right to inflict harm on another person. And so I think the basics of this are just simply true, that every surgical abortion that has ever been done stops a beating heart and stops measurable brainwaves. What do we call it when a heart is beating and brainwaves are there? We call it life. What do we call it when those are taken away? It's the taking of life. And so with all of the debate and all the things people say, people intuitively and scientifically know this is a child. And you'll hear, I remember a famous pro-choice advocate who was in the United States Senate, and he was always arguing for the right to abortion and that these really aren't babies, they're blobs of tissue. And then he was talking about that he had this many grandchildren and then another one on the way, and who is a girl, and she's going to be born in September. And he was all excited, and you're going, okay, so you've just said it. You know that unborn child is a human being. You know it's a girl. You know it's your granddaughter, and you're looking forward to her arrival into the world. What's going to change in her nature when she's moved 20-some inches from inside the womb to outside the womb? Nothing. Her development will only be a few seconds further along, yet it would have been legal in those days to have aborted her all the way up until birth. And so I think if people just understand this, that because they are weak and vulnerable, because people say, well, it's just a small little thing, you know, and you go, well, first of all, it's not a thing, it's a person. And secondly, it's really small. So are you saying, and that's why we should take its life? Because don't we normally think that the weakest and most vulnerable children are the ones who most need our help and advocacy? I mean, you know that in Water Mission. I mean, it's the children who move our hearts. The child that I'm looking at over, well, it's my right-hand side. I guess it's your left shoulder, whatever. I'm just looking at it right now and I'm going, wow. I mean, just, that's who it's about. That's who matters. And the child in the womb is the child in the earliest stages of development, but fully 100% a child. And by the way, not part of the mother's body, because if that child's part of mother's body, it means the mother has four eyes, two noses, four ears, two mouths, and also half the time has male sexual organs. We all know that's not true. It's not. It's a separate body that is residing inside the mother, and temporarily. And if she can just hang on and we can help her hang on, we can get that child out into the hands of somebody who really wants that child. And so I used to debate Planned Parenthood, and their slogan was every child a wanted child. And I would always say, I agree, every child a wanted child. And so how do you finish that sentence? I finished that sentence, every child a wanted child. So we should learn to want children before they're born, and we should get children into the hands of people who want them. And then I would say in the debate with Planned Parenthood, how do you finish the sentence, every child a wanted child? You say it all the time. And they say, well, I don't even know what you mean. I mean, I've never finished the sentence. I say, right, because you would have to finish the sentence, every child a wanted child. So let's identify unwanted children and kill them before they're born, which not only won't fit on a bumper sticker, but doesn't sound very good. And rightly so. It doesn't sound very good because it isn't good.
Randy, you've dedicated so much of your life to teaching, to providing proper perspective. And I really appreciate the way that you have walked us through some very rational ideas of how we approach these different topics that often are very heated. Appreciate you giving us some ideas on how we can shed the truth of God's word and do it in a manner that is loving also. I want to ask you on a final question, what do you hope your legacy leaves? What do you hope that is written or said about you after you leave this earth and go to be with Jesus?
Well, I hope that people will say, and I hope in saying it, they'll say it because it was true. He loved Jesus with all of his heart, and he showed others the love of Jesus, that they could see Jesus in him. And you know, that every day is my goal. When I meet people, when I talk with people, I coach high school tennis. So now this is sports related. Okay. Coach high school tennis, and I want those kids to see Jesus in me. I got a note from one of the kids the other day, just moved my heart, and told me how much he admired me, and he thanked me, and he even gave me a gift certificate to a sporting goods store. I mean, how often does that happen? And I was so touched that he is, I hope, seeing Jesus in me. And that will make a difference in his life. And that's what I want for all that I do. The books that I write, when I speak places, this interview, I pray that between you and I talking together, that somebody listening, their heart will be touched and changed and moved for eternity, that a process will begin in them. And God will use this to take them further in their walk with him. And that one day we'll all celebrate that together in the presence of Jesus.
Indeed, we will. And I had a picture in my mind as you and I were preparing for this interview, and you were making a joke about how you couldn't throw a ball as fast as I could. And I said, well, I can't throw a ball fast anymore either because of three shoulder surgeries. But I had this image of me and you playing catch in heaven, and we'll both be popping the mitt on the other side.
Yeah. What a beautiful thing. And, you know, it is interesting because that's one of the things I deal with in the heaven book. And one of the ways we get heaven wrong is that I've got almost a whole chapter in the heaven book on sports and heaven. And you think, well, what do you mean that sports in heaven? That's ridiculous. I had a pastor tell me one time, well, there's not going to be sports in heaven. I said, wait a minute, we're going to have resurrected bodies and we're going to be living on a resurrected earth. Do you think Satan is the one that came up with the idea of sports? I mean, or do you think God, we're made in the image of God, and part of being in his image is coming up with the idea of challenging our bodies, competing and all this? And then he said, yeah, but you know, it's all so sinful because competition and people get angry and this happens and the pride and all that. And I go, you're forgetting. There's not going to be any pride. There's not going to be any sin. We will be able to compete with each other and enjoy each other's presence. And by the way, an analogy I use in that regard sometimes is when, as I say, coaching high school tennis, there was a kid who was our number one singles player. And for years, all the way through his junior year, every time we played, we competed, I beat him. And then his senior year, and I'd worked with him, probably played with him three times a week. His senior year, he beat me for the first time. I ran to the net. He ran to the net. We wrapped our arms around each other. I was crying a little bit, not because I lost, but because he won. Why? Because I had vested interest in his success. I was his coach. And so what in heaven, we will all have vested interest in each other's success, not just in our success, but in their success. And I literally, and this is no exaggeration, I never let him beat me, but I was happier by far for him and his beating me than I ever was in beating him. And if that's true of me while I still have a sin nature, for crying out loud, how much more true will that be on the new earth?
Yeah, I love that. I heard somebody say one time, you know, if Jesus was a pitcher, he would have thrown inside too. I don't know if that's theologically correct, but but yeah, he wouldn't try to hit anybody, but he would make sure that they know that he right. owns the inside part of the plate.
Right. Be fully capable of succeeding in not hitting somebody, but getting as close as divinely possible.
That's great.
Pretty close.
Well, Randy, thank you so much for this conversation. Thank you for the way you use what God has given you to bless many people.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for what you're doing. Water Mission, what a great ministry, and one that I'm just encourage people to support.
Amen.